Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, actor Ryan Kwanten and writer-director Patrick Hughes discuss their new film, Red Hill, which opens up in limited release this Friday, November 5th.
So much.
And Jerry, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I was waiting for that cue, the theme music, but no such luck. No, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm good. We're having problems with our switchboard tonight. So no opening.
Okay, we're gonna
music.
Wing it. We're gonna wing it. All right. All right. You know what the theme music sounds like, okay? I mean,
exactly.
Come on. We all know.
Hang on. All right. I give up.
All right.
Here we go.
Woohoo! Thank God.
Thanks for joining us tonight for another exciting episode of Movie Geeks United.
And it is exciting because we have the legendary Stackhouse on tonight, so that's great. You know,
that's right.
No,
hey,
I like
tell
this
you.
Guy. I love this actor. I love him on True Blood. So this is going to be really. I'm really looking forward to this interview.
Yeah, he's fantastic on True Blood, and a lot of people that haven't heard interviews with the talent on True Blood or. Might not know that. I mean, he's Australian. As is Bill, the actor that plays Bill, Stephen Moyer. They're both Australians, I think.
That's really incredible. What I notice is we've always seen this about Colin Farrell. Whoever does his dialect coaching, how they keep their accents, they can just transform them into anything. They're vocal chameleons. But that's really impressive for those two. I would never have guessed that. That's incredible.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we wonder at Meryl Streep that pulls off a roster, like a whole catalog of foreign accents.
Yeah.
So, and we rarely think how difficult it must be to master the English accent because and all the different dialects throughout the country because, I mean, we're very, very specific. So it is a chore, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, but, I mean, it's just amazing how they do it. I mean, someone like Tilda Swinton or Cate Blanchett, it's just amazing
how,
I mean, I'm just always thunderstruck how they do this.
Yeah. So that's coming up tonight. What's going on, Jerry, in your neck of the woods?
Well, I watched The Walking Dead after our show. I watched Dexter, then The Walking Dead, and I was really impressed with The Walking Dead. I'm really looking forward to watching the whole thing now. But that was a great opening episode. I was really impressed with that. And I haven't caught up with Boardwalk Empire yet. And so I'll have to watch that this weekend. So
it was good this weekend.
It was.
You know,
it's getting better. It's getting better.
It is. And, you know, I was watching some stuff in honor of Halloween. Of course, it was, you know, that kind of material was all over the television set.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't escape
over the weekend.
It.
I watched this bio, Making of Halloween, that they played on the Bio channel. It's a two-hour special. It's very, very interesting. I love stories about, you know, none of them thought it would amount to anything, and they were completely unsuspecting. They thought they were making a schlock movie, and it turns out to be this big classic that lives on forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are great, great stories.
Yeah. It is incredible how that is still with us. And it is. It's a lot of people's all-time favorite film. And I have to say, definitely one of the best films in that genre.
It really is. And, you know, and it's entirely John Carpenter, I think. Because his economy, his style of shooting, a very classic style
mm-hmm.
of shooting.
Right.
And his restraint, I mean, the movie shows a lot of restraint. You know, when you look at comparable horror movies, even made in that time, it's very little blood, a lot of suggestion. And he really does portray it like the boogeyman in that classic shadowy sense of the boogeyman. It's it almost feels old-fashioned in a way.
Well, it certainly feels old-fashioned. You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I went back for Halloween and I reread, you know, the review I wrote of the Rob Zombie one. And I like parts of the Rob Zombie one, but it does come down to, does this need to be explained? And
yeah.
Especially, I think he ruins everything in the sequel, personally. I think it's all, any goodwill, the first one is sort of done away with in the first 10 minutes, I think, of the second one. But
plays no role in that original one. And
yeah.
It would fall apart under that weight.
Yeah. It brings up a good point, though, about, you know, if a lot of the great movies we like were remade, how different they'd be, much longer. There would be so many, like, flashbacks and backstories, you know. That Carpenter did that very well. He did that very well with that film. There's no doubt about it. And that goes with the original, what they did with the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And they didn't need to explain anything. It is just right there.
Yeah. And another thing that really worked about it is that the premise alone is silly. I mean, it's schlocky.
Yeah.
A masked killer wipes out babysitters on Halloween night. You know,
right.
It sounds like a Roger Corman movie, or even, you know, worse than that. And Roger Corman's great, but you know what I'm saying. Even schlockier than a Corman movie.
Right, right. No, I hear you. I hear you. I know what you're saying.
But obviously they avoided those traps just with pure technique, storytelling, good old-fashioned storytelling. So I saw that, and that was interesting. And I haven't really seen anything since last time, other than, you know, Unstoppable and Love and Other Drugs, which I talked about last time.
Right, right. And this weekend, what do we have? Due Date and Megamind. I think next weekend is Unstoppable. And then the weekend after that, Harry Potter. And then Thanksgiving, we get Love and Other Drugs. So there's some interesting stuff coming out. There is some news, though. True Grit got pushed up by 3 days. So that's interesting. And
well, Christmas Eve tends to be a slower time in the movies.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's no movie shows on Christmas Eve. No midnight shows on Christmas Eve, that's for sure.
Yeah.
A
lot of theaters actually cut out their late shows on Christmas
Eve. Yeah, they do.
But Christmas Day is one of the biggest days. And so I guess they're getting a jump on the competition by 3 days, so maybe they can win that weekend.
Right.
In total gross, total 5-day gross or whatever that is. But man, I think it looks great. I'm salivating over True Grit. And I just arranged with Paramount today to attend their press screening, so I'll be reporting on that early too.
All right,
can't wait. So let's talk about Red Hill for a second. Red Hill is the movie that we'll be discussing tonight with Ryan Kwanten and the writer director Patrick Hughes. It is Mr. Hughes' first feature film, and it's kind of a new, like a modern-day Australian outback western. And they make very interesting westerns in Australia.
Yes, they do.
I mean, the Australian landscape is just ideal for the western genre, the desolation. And this one's really good. It's about a new police officer that enters this small Australian town. It's his first day in the job, the same day that a serial killer, the most savage ever known in the area, escapes from prison and seeks vengeance against the department and the sheriff that put him away. And so it has a very classic Western structure to it, but it goes in places that you don't expect. And, you know, we've seen everything.
Right.
We've seen every cliche in the book. So when I say that the movie takes a surprising turn, I really mean it. And,
okay. Cool.
And Ryan is terrific in it. The villain in it is really reminiscent of Anton Chigurh in No Country, which No
That's
Country
was a very
was
a, high compliment.
It was a big inspiration for this film, No Country, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked to Ryan and Patrick about the movie. The movie opens up in limited release this Friday, November 5th, and I'm sure that'll be a platform release, and it'll come out in additional cities in the weeks to come. But it'll also be available on DVD as well pretty soon. Here are both of them talking about the film.
When a blow-in requests a transfer to my outpost, I count on two things. Either he's lazy, or he's an upstart looking for an easy promotion.
I was shot on duty, sir. The doctor said we should move somewhere quiet, away from the city.
Approximately 9 a.m, Jimmy Conway break out of the maximum security prison at Western Bay.
Conway was convicted of murdering his wife and the attempted murder of a Red Hill police officer.
We all know what we're dealing with here. Jimmy Conway rides into this town. He'll be bringing hell with him.
He's cutting his damn lights off!
We'll play him at his own game. Stop running, we start hunting.
Where's the backup?
There isn't any.
What the hell's going on here?
You tell me, son. Come on, Jimmy! I know you're out there!
I love your movie. I think it's... I think it's a kick-ass movie. I don't know any other way to say it.
We like the word badass.
How can you put that into your...
you have to say it's badass.
Let me ask you about the inspiration for it, because this is... it seems to follow the structure and the themes of a classic Western very well. So were those films of particular influence to you, Patrick?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've always been a huge fan of Westerns, and it wasn't until I reached a certain age that I really truly understood what the Western was. You know, like when I was younger, my dad was always trying to make me watch them, and I just wasn't interested. I was more interested in watching Star Wars, but then you get older and you realize Star Wars is, in fact, a Western. And, you know, I think as you get a little bit older and you mature, I think this is why men connect with the Westerns so much, is it's about a moral code, and it's about a sense of justice and what is right and what is wrong. And I guess, you know, I wanted to tell a tale that was an exploration of revenge, redemption, and sacrifice. And kind of like that spin, if one man's revenge can be another man's redemption. That, to me, I'm kind of drawn to that. And, you know, it was kind of, you know, Shane Cooper is the character for Ryan. You know, we said from the outset that this wasn't your classic Western character. Ryan was saying the other day that it was sort of like a prequel to a Clint Eastwood movie. This is, he's not the badass hero from the beginning. He's actually the young cop, the city cop, that believes in, you know, he has a strong sense of his moral code and what is right and what is wrong. And he also has a strong sense of police procedure about how to do things by the book and do it properly. So, his arc is ultimately through this shitstorm that he has to live through. In this one day, his first day on duty in this small country town, he learns to grow, and he grows from this experience. And obviously, the city boy becomes a cowboy.
Yeah, and Ryan, is that what really appealed to you? The arc of that character, as Patrick just described it.
I'm a huge fan of the Western genre. As well, and have a huge sort of catalogue of Western titles in my DVD collection. But this was a character that was, you know, I guess set up somewhat to be the hero, yet didn't have the classic sort of hero qualities. He wasn't, as Patrick alluded to, sort of John Wayne or Clint Eastwood, that you felt like no matter what posse was put up against them, he could overcome it. In fact, the very first frame we see this guy, he's forgotten his gun. I mean, it's not. This is not Clint Eastwood. You know, this is. Having said that, though, he knows his job. He's a great city cop. He's just happened to start work in this country town on the worst day imaginable.
Yeah, and he's very vulnerable, as I think the best heroes are, and it works as a great counterpoint to your villain in the piece,
yeah.
Which the villain is almost mythic in a way. But you also, what surprised me about it, was that you also give him a lot of colors as well. I mean, his character and his character's mm-hmm. motivation deepens as the story moves along also. That must have been an important consideration for you too.
Yeah, exactly. We wanted to sort of, how do you humanize a monster? So he's portrayed as this sort of angel of death that stalks into this town, and he's horribly disfigured, and he doesn't say anything. You know, from the outset when I was sitting down to write, I'm like, this guy's not going to say a goddamn word until the last possible frame of the movie. And by him not saying anything, all we can judge are his actions, and his actions are horrific. So, what Shane's character represents is sort of the moral compass in this story, because there's some pretty nasty and dirty characters. You know, old Bill is someone that we can't really empathize with, and nor can we with Jimmy. So it's sort of, I like that idea that slowly, piece by piece, you know, Shane's sort of gathering information and learning new insights about this town and their history, and starts to put a broader picture together of the past and this terrible secret that this town's hiding. We had certain moments with Jimmy. It was like, again, like as Shane's gathering that information, I also wanted to sort of, you know, that reversal, we start to learn the truth about Jimmy. You know, if you saved it for some sort of big shock reversal at the end, it would kind of feel a bit kind of Scooby-Doo. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it was, you know, it was important that it was step by step. So initially, you know, it's really confronting his actions. And then piece by piece, as we move through the film, we learn a little bit more and a little bit more. And obviously there's a connection between him and Shane. And, you know, I really like that idea of the baby book name. So, because it kind of says everything without saying anything. You just understand suddenly, oh my God, this guy is actually a human being. So that was really important too.
You know, what I liked about it was, obviously, you're working in the Western genre. It's a very old, traditional genre, and its beauty is its simplicity, as you expressed before. I mean, it's about good and evil, right and wrong, moral code. But I would think that it would be easy to fall into types with the performances and the writing of the characters. So was that a consideration also for you, Ryan, how to make this character specific, or was it all on the page already?
That was the incredibly impressive thing about the script, was the lack of exposition, that everything, it was, the fat was off the bone. You know, it was just, it was all there. I mean, the amount of stuff that probably found its way to the cutting room floor was few and far between, purely, I mean, I guess the budget kind of...
We couldn't afford it.
it was a very appealing quality.
Yeah. You know, and I understand that you guys shot this in 4 weeks.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated in independent films.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated to hear both of your takes on this. Obviously, the greatest luxury for a film production would be more time. And money, but is it beneficial in any way to not have the opportunity to necessarily second guess yourself?
That's an amazing point, and it's something that, in retrospect, or I guess in nostalgia now, and Patrick and I talk about it. If we would have had more money, more time, would we have made? We would have made a different film. That much we know, but would we have made a better film? That much I don't know, because I almost see it now as like a beautiful. As like a relationship. If you look at a relationship, it's you fall in love with someone for the perfections that they have, for the things that you see in them. But you stay in love with them because of the imperfections, because of little things that they do, quirks that they have. And that's how I feel now about the film. I fell in love with it because, and I signed on for it because of the Western genre, because of Patrick. But I'm now, I hold it in such high regard because of the situations that we were in, because of how much we had the band together, because of the good times that it reminds me, and that it was good old-fashioned filmmaking, and that's why I like it, and I think that's why people are responding to it in that same sort of way. You sense that rawness, you sense that ruggedness, but more than anything, you sense the tribulations and then the triumph.
Mm. Yeah. Tell me about that reaction that you guys have received for the film, because I'm sure you guys have had screenings and you've played festivals, I'm sure. What has that reaction from the audience been?
I mean, it's been incredible. I remember we went to, when Ryan and I were at Berlin Film Festival for the world premiere, and that was, you know, it was a long way from Omeo where we shot the film. And, you know, when we made the film, we made it without a distributor attached. It was just, we made it with private money, and I mortgaged my house, and you know, it was just against all odds. We were just up there. We said, right, we've got 4 weeks. We've got incredible crew. We've got incredible cast. Let's just tell the best story we can. And ultimately, that was every day. I just, you know, that was my mantra inside my head. Just tell the story. Just tell the story. Just tell the story. Because you're not going to have all the bells and whistles. So it was really exciting, and it was such a relief, like, obviously, when we played it, because Berlin...
You're not thinking when you're on set, oh, this is going to look so good in Berlin.
I don't even know if we'll get into a festival, let alone if we get a distributor.
Let alone if we'll make today.
On top of that, I might lose my house, and my wife will leave me.
The perils of independent filmmaking.
The reaction from audience has been really astounding. I mean, I just got back from Spain where we had a screening at Sitges, and, you know, got a standing ovation and people were cheering. And, you know, I guess, you know, I remember watching Unforgiven when I was younger, and I remember literally cheering, literally leaping out of my seat when he walks in and says, "Who's the asshole owns this shithole?" and starts blowing away everyone in the room, because it's like that sense of justice. And I think that's what people are drawn to Westerns about, and that's why they worked in this day and age, why, you know, every man, I know Ryan wanted to be in a Western, and I certainly wanted to make a Western, so there's kind of that manly element of standing up and taking charge and control of a situation that's gone AWOL.
Well, a couple of things interest me here, because, Patrick, you are the, I know I'm going to miss one of your titles, the director, writer, producer, editor, of the film. So when you're so close to it, particularly in the editing phase, is it hard to have perspective on whether or not it's working?
Yeah, it was horrible, and also it was just because of money. I just had to cut, like, you know, this whole film was like an extremely grueling process, and like Ryan said, it's like one that we look back on now with, you know, I know I'll never have the freedom I had making that movie ever again, and I'll probably look back and say that was the most fun I ever had making a movie, because there was so much at stake and there's so much at risk. You know, I guess, you know, if I was, you know, certainly on my next film, I won't be editing it. I know that for sure. Because it's extremely hard to find a distance. And I know that, like, the first cut I did was, like, 2 hours long, and then I did test screenings, and, you know, And the whole process was rushed too, because at the end of the day, I'd had a year off work. I had to go back and start shooting commercials again to get my kids fed. So it was the pressure and strain was coming from it at all angles. But it's kind of like I just got really inspired. I wrote a list of all my favorite filmmakers. You know, George Miller and the Coen brothers. And Nolan and Robert Rodriguez and all those, every single one of them just went out, all of their first films, they wrote, directed, produced, edited, did the coffee, did the standby props, you know, like, just do whatever you got to take to get the goddamn film in the can and tell a story and get it in front of a sales agent, and then maybe the sales agent can sell it around the world. That's, you know, that's the filmmaker's sort of dream. In some respects, I kind of felt like I was going back to the way I was making films in film school, which is you kind of feel like you're doing everything and your mum's out there making sandwiches.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, the gamble paid off, because this is a great film, and I think that everyone's going to love it. And Ryan, you are phenomenal in the movie, and you're also phenomenal in True Blood, and my listeners would kill me if I don't ask you about True Blood. Are you shooting the next season currently?
I am not. I go back the 1st of December.
Oh, okay. And tell me about the TV audiences, because you're obviously, the show is very popular. It's one of the most popular shows on TV. Is there a different reaction from fans because they feel like they're more intimate with you or know you personally as opposed to a film work that you do?
Yeah, it's a very perceptive point. It's that. It's also the fact that HBO, and I guess it's probably more Alan's call, the fact that they let character arcs happen over the course of an entire season, or sometimes even two seasons. So you feel that much more invested in the characters that are shown to you. So you and then they immediately associate me, if I get spotted on the street, with that character. So it's a blessing and a curse, I guess. It's afforded me opportunities like Red Hill and other films that have been fortunate enough to come my way.
Hey, I'm Jason. Jason Stackhouse.
You are even better looking than you are yesterday.
Former Bon Ton QB1. Ladies want me and guys won't be me.
I want to be you.
Yeah, I'm sure you heard all about me.
That boy is sex on his dick.
So I was just going about my business until girls started turning up dead. My best friend turned into a serial killer. And my sister started dating a vampire.
I don't think that's a good idea.
I don't think it's any of your business.
And after Amy died, well, that's when I turned to the Fellowship of the Sun.
Hallelujah!
They were going to help bring me from the darkness into the light.
Let me help you find your way back to joy.
I guess God works in mysterious ways. Because when I finally opened my eyes, I saw that they were trying to wage a war.
Amen.
And use me
Amen.
As their weapon. That didn't sit too well with me. Or Jesus. When I got home, turns out Bon Ton had gone to hell.
This is the war I've been training for.
And that's exactly where me and Andy Belfleur sent Mary Ann, I think.
We got her?
But somehow, trouble, well, it found me again. And this time, I screwed myself real bad.
I just want to tell you guys, I love the movie, and we haven't even talked about the film score for the movie, and I'm a huge fan of film scores, and this score was fantastic.
No, it really is. I'm a huge fan of film scores. I've been collecting them on vinyl since I was about 10. So I'm like the world's worst, biggest critic of... And I found Dmitry Golovko. Please put a plug in for him. The CD is coming out next week. He just did a phenomenal job. And like the same way we made this film, I mean, he just made this score with nothing. It was kind of like alchemy. I don't know how he did it. But he wrote the score from reading the script. We sat down and I gave him the script and we talked about tone and atmosphere and ambience and the kind of vibe we wanted to create and the world of this town. And he literally just, you know, I think like a week later he sent me all these thematic tracks. He sent me Shane's theme and Red Hill theme. And I was, so while we were shooting the film, Ryan and I would be like driving out to location and I'd put Dimitri's score on. So we had the score before we shot the movie and it was kind of, it was really cool. Like, you know, we'd play it while we were looking at rushes. You know, at the end of each week we'd set up rushes in the town hall and we'd play Dimitri's score while watching the rushes. And it kind of just had,
wow.
You know, we wanted to kind of make a film that had that kind of visceral experience where it's kind of, you know, the images and there's sort of a grandness to it and a scale, and the score obviously had to bring that as well.
Patrick Hughes, the writer-director of Red Hill, and his star, Ryan Kwanten from True Blood, opens Friday. Go see it. And I don't know if it's going to be an on-demand title, but I definitely know it has a DVD release before too long.
Okay, no, that's great. No, that's a great interview. That was just really encouraging and everything from a lot of standpoints. So, but that was really good. Those guys are great.
They start shooting in December for True Blood, as Ryan said.
There you go.
Said.
You got that. We have that. We have True Blood nugget for you.
You know, when you're in a press junket kind of situation and you only have 15 or 20 minutes with them, and especially when it's a group, you know, it's more than one person one-on-one.
Right.
It's hard to focus very much on their other projects because
right.
you're
that was
you're
a
main...
press junket. That was
yeah.
that was that dude. That was very. They were really good, really with it for a press junket. That's that was a really good interview. I mean, you really
yeah,
got
I think
a lot
I had
out
them,
of them.
I think I had them later in the day too. So
yeah, that was great.
All... yeah, but I had to get a True Blood question out there. I apologize if there's not as much True Blood material in that as the fans would have wanted. But all right, I asked our co-host to call in. Let's see if he's on the line.
Down.
He is on the line. Chris, main man.
Hey.
Hi.
Chris.
Hi.
What's up, boys? What's up, fellas?
Wow, hey. He's using the word fellas. Oh, God.
Yeah. Man, that's a phrase like television set. No one's used that since the Eisenhower administration.
Good one. Very good one.
Yeah, where did I get that from?
Hey, God only knows.
I asked you a question on Facebook earlier today. When is your wife expecting? What's the due date?
The due date. Oh, please don't associate it with a movie that does not have a single laugh in it.
Did you see that?
Have you seen it? Have you seen it, or you just know? Same feeling all do about it.
Yeah, I was saying, as far as I can tell, it doesn't have a single laugh in it. Yeah, I was actually watching that preview with someone the other night, and they said, they showed all the funny parts. I was like, did they show funny parts?
All right, so what's the date?
No, my wife is due in about 9 weeks, due January 6th, something like that.
Good.
You know, that is when we will be bringing another little movie geek into the world. So.
Wow.
Yeah. All right.
We'll talk about movies, I promise, but are you scared?
Am I scared? No, I wouldn't say that I'm scared. No, I'm a little nervous about being a father and all that kind of stuff, if I'm being honest, but I wouldn't say I'm scared. I'm excited. I'm very
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very pleased. You're, it's like a happy nervousness.
Mhm.
Well, you're going to be great.
Yeah.
You're one of the people in my life that I've always cherished the most. So I think you're going to be a great dad.
Thank you very
Definitely.
Much, buddy. That means a lot to me. It really does.
All right, shithead. Let's see.
All right.
Okay. Tell me what you think of this, Chris and Jerry. We talked a little bit about Avatar, about Cameron announcing the next two Avatars. So I thought it would take 10 years of his time, at least. Apparently not, because the release date for the second Avatar is December of 2014,
mm-hmm.
with the third one to follow the next December in 2015. So I guess he's going to shoot them concurrently, like a Back to the Future, Lord of the Rings type thing.
Right.
Now, I think I have another bet going.
Oh, with O'Brien?
Yes. Because we bet, he said there's no way Avatar will be the biggest movie of the year. That was my bet. Yes, it will be. So now, he still hasn't learned his...
What did he think would be the biggest movie of the year? Do you remember?
Whatever the big movie during the summer was last year, which I can't recall. It has to
he thought Transformers 2 would really end up being the big...
Well, without Avatar, it would have been.
Yeah, it might be right. Yeah, you're right. Gross-wise, yeah.
But, so I think that's where we were leaning. But even now, he hasn't learned his lesson. He's saying... it's no way it's going to be the biggest movie of the year. Lightning can't strike twice. I'm like,
it's not
Cameron. It can.
It's not lightning. It's not some random occurrence. Like, it's a sequel to a very popular movie.
Popular of all time. Even if it grows half as much, it'll be the biggest of the year.
Right.
Yeah.
When something's predictable, you don't compare it to lightning, you know? Like, if I stick my finger in a socket and I get shot, I don't say it was, like, getting struck by lightning. Like, no, that's what's going to happen, you know?
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, the third one, it all depends upon the strength and the power of the second one.
Right.
And how it leaves you if you just have to see that third one after you get out of the second one.
Right,
so,
it could be a Matrix situation.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. You can't rule that out.
It could be. And The Matrix, obviously, was designed with, you know, kind of cliffhanger endings. So
right.
So you would be inspired to watch the next one. But gross-wise, and I wouldn't say necessarily creative-wise, because I like the third one more than the second one, but just by a scotch.
Right. They're interesting
diminishing returns. Diminishing returns. As the series went on.
Yeah. By the time the second Matrix movie was over, the first one took everyone by such surprise that we were all anticipating the sequel so highly, and it was just such a letdown in a sort of inexplicable way. Like, it was just sort of too much of something that. Too much talking and too much action, but not the kind that mattered. And it's weird how a sequel can really just not work like that. And if you would have told me after the first Matrix movie that they're going to make two more, and by the time the third one comes out, no one's going to give a shit, I would have told you you were a liar.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what happened. So I would make the same argument about Avatar. Like someone said that the sequels were, you know, by the time the third one comes out, no one will give a shit. It seems impossible, but it has happened before.
And again,
we're talking about James Cameron, so that changes mm-hmm. everything.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize we had a ghetto woman on the show
now. Yeah.
I'm Strom
Thurmond. That's what I am. If it pleases the court. No. But another trilogy that had diminishing returns was Back to the Future. I actually watched the first one again tonight. Because it just was released on Blu-ray, and man, what an ingenious, perfectly structured script that first one was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
God. I would argue that the second one is equally strong. I've always thought that the second Back to the Future movie is just as good as the first one. A really great, really underrated sequel, and then the third one is just way out there, just completely wrong. Just feels completely out of place and wrong.
Mm.
But yeah, the first two especially are fantastic. By the way, did you see the Saturday Night Live?
Yes.
Nothing
Back to the
was
Future auditions.
That,
yeah.
Yeah, nothing was better than that Alan Alda impression that you hated.
That was good.
That was spot on. Oh man, was that great?
Pacino playing Doc Brown. Great, Scott.
Great, Scott.
Yeah, occasionally Saturday Night Live hits the bullseye there. So
that was one of the few times this season that it did.
Actually,
really,
I thought the whole episode of last week's show was really 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 funny. The best stuff they've done in a couple years. But hey, listen, since we're talking about Avatar, it brings up something I kind of wanted to talk about because I loved Avatar. It's my favorite movie of the year. I thought it was just everything. Like I loved the story. People mm-hmm. were shitting on that, but I loved the story. But mostly, I just loved the experience of watching it. But even I, as much as I love it, and I'm the biggest defender the movie has, even I don't really have an appetite. Forget a third one after the second one. I don't really have a huge appetite for a second one. And maybe mm-hmm. I'm just burnt out on sequels. I just don't. I mean, I kind of want to. I'm kind of trigger shy about sequels. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't really believe that they're going to be that good, ever.
That's a good point.
And Cameron has made, you know, one of the best sequels of all time. He made Aliens, which was, you know, and he made Terminator 2, which was another one of the best sequels of all time. So he's certainly proven himself on that ground, and he's proven himself on every ground that exists. But I just don't have this huge appetite. And listen to this. I read this article the other day, and listen to the movies. Yeah, you read the article about Jon Favreau calling 2011 a box office bloodbath. It was not a story. It wasn't like some, you know, controversial thing he said. It was just an article about him talking about all the movies that were coming out next year.
And up against his Cowboys and Aliens, right?
Up against his Cowboys and Aliens, which might as well be a sequel because, you know, I mean, doesn't, you know, just big sci-fi action summer movie, you know.
It's been in development for a long time too. I mean,
it has. Spielberg was attached to it.
That was like the early '90s, I think.
He's still producing, I think, actually.
Yeah, and doesn't it? I think it's got like Robert Downey and Daniel Craig, doesn't it? Or is Robert Downey still involved?
Harrison Ford. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you know, I mean, that sounds interesting and something original. But listen to this. I'm going to read off a list of about 11 movies that are coming out in 2011, and he's right. It is going to be a bloodbath because these are all summer movies that are coming out: Green Lantern, Thor, Captain America, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, Transformers: The Dark of the Moon, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, The Hangover 2, Cars 2, Kung Fu Panda 2, The Kaboom of Doom, Smurfs 3D, X-Men First Class, and Rise of the Apes. That's all next year in the summertime. Those are all, you know, sequels are generally, or, you know, like the Green
Lantern. Diminishing Returns,
Green Lantern is not a sequel, but it might as well be.
Well, let me say this. I already can see the headline in the New York Times in the Arts and Leisure section halfway through the summer, Superhero Fatigue.
Yeah.
That's a headline right there. And then Reboot Fatigue, too. by the end of the summer. So
right, right. I mean, you might as well call things like Green Lantern and Smurfs, even though there's never been a Smurfs movie or a Green Lantern movie, you might as well just go ahead and call it a reboot because they had
TV
shows.
Existing commodities.
Yeah,
right, right, right.
I don't have a good feeling about Thor or Captain America. I have a better feeling about Thor out of the two of them. But I smell trouble for Marvel with these two movies.
Well, yeah, it does seem. And these are big characters. People call them like third-tier characters. Yep. But those are huge characters in the Marvel universe.
Yeah.
But both of these movies, even with the involvement of Kenneth Branagh, I got to agree with you, both of them. And we haven't seen a trailer for either one, so it's hard to judge. But just
right.
based on what we do know, I sort of smell trouble too. It feels very, very. I don't know, Thor. Many of us did see the sort of leaked footage from Comic-Con before it was taken off. Did you guys see that?
No, I didn't.
It was like a 5 or 6 minute preview, basically.
Yeah. I'd like to add something to this because both of these movies, as was the Incredible Hulk and even the second Iron Man movie, these movies are nothing more, and I said this before on the show, nothing more than basically 2-hour advertisements for the Avengers movie. That's what this is all. It's fair to call them movies. They're almost like plot points to something much bigger. And this anticipation that they're setting up for this movie is enormous. And if that fails, then this whole enterprise has been a waste.
Well, from Marvel's point of view, I agree with you. I think it would be unfair to say or think that Kenneth Branagh made this movie as a teaser for the Avengers.
Oh, I don't think he did, but from Marvel's point of view, it just feels like we talked about this even though I thought Iron Man 2 was fun, but it just felt like every other scene was the Avengers. We're building up to the Avengers, and it's just like this movie has to really be pretty spectacular the way you're hyping it in each of these films. So
Captain America just smells cheesy to me. I mean,
it smells dated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They made a TV movie of it when I think it was the late 70s or early 80s, and it was awful. It was just really bad.
And they tried a big screen version of it too.
That went direct to video, I think.
They wanted theatrical, but they didn't get it apparently.
Right.
But.
Yeah, Joe Johnson, I don't want to talk bad about him because he's made some solid movies, you know. I don't know, The Wolfman, like, I do feel like a lot of the stuff that worked in The Wolfman was not his idea. And I'm not basing that on anything. It's just,
right.
You know, I know it came out of literally, like, fell out of Mark Romanek's hands and did not hit the floor by the time Joe Johnson, you know, caught it or was handed it.
Right.
So, he's not someone who I equate with, you know, like really quality, memorable stuff. He's somebody who I equate with watchable, you know, entertaining sort of family action movies.
He's competent,
right.
Which is exactly what they needed for Wolfman and the bind that they were in. They needed somebody that can come in and finish the movie.
Right.
Right.
You know.
And he did a good job. You know, he picked up the pieces and put together a movie that's, you know, not what it was supposed to be, but put together pretty well for the situation they were in. But I really agree with you, and I wonder if you and I and probably Jerry are sort of instinctively feeling that way about these two movies. I wonder if audiences are going to smell it too, because audiences can kind of strangely smell that kind of shit sometimes, you know? Like, they can sort of smell when something doesn't feel right, you know?
I was talking about this with my mom because, you know, we all went to go see Wolverine and reported back on it, and we were all really disappointed or just like, you've got to be kidding me kind of thing after watching it. And this whole news that Aronofsky's going to direct the second one, that's all fine and dandy and everything, but, you know, the Wolverine problem, even though I guess the character is not an X-Men first class from what I understand, I don't think at all for some reason. I'm not positive on that, but...
Well, that's what Bryan Singer said today.
I don't know what's true and what's not true. But it's Wolverine 2. It's like you're talking about you're not eager for a sequel to Avatar. Well, I certainly wasn't clamoring for Wolverine 2 at the end of that one. I thought they took a great character and sort of trashed him right before our eyes.
Yeah, I love Aronofsky, and I've loved, you know, a couple of his movies very, very much. Mm-hmm. But, like, this is sort of akin to if it had been announced in 1990 that Stanley Kubrick was going to direct a sequel to Ghost Dad, you know? Like, I'd have been like,
It was between that and Napoleon. You're right.
That's the movie.
The movie
was great lost film.
That, it was that bad. Like, I do put Wolverine on, like, the Ghost Dad level. Like, I mean, like, really, like, sort of cringe-inducing, embarrassingly bad filmmaking and acting, like, across the boards. Like, really good cast in that movie, too. Some people that I really, really admire quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I mean, Kubrick
had on his table, because I've been doing lots of research about him, so I'm surprised you knew this. I mean, he had Ghost Dad 2 and Napoleon side by side. And
how do you choose? Do you just, like, basically put, you know, close your eyes and just pick?
Well, I think it all came down to he always wanted to work with Bill Cosby. He knew he couldn't do that in Napoleon.
They had a love of sweaters, of awful sweaters.
That's right. That's right.
And look, I'll even one up you. There's another film you mentioned, and I didn't realize it was next summer. Look, after the Planet of the Apes remake, I wasn't clamoring for any more apes. That this thing has been announced last year, this script, which is supposed to be hark back to the 68 version. As much as I like James Franco, and I think he can really do no wrong right now in my book, I just don't. There was not a demand. It's like after the first Tomb Raider, there was not a demand when I left the theater. Oh, I really want to see a sequel to this. And it's the same way the Planet of the Apes remake was so bland. It's like, I leave it alone.
Well, let me say this. Let me say this one thing. A lot been getting in the last 5 years, maybe even more than that. We've been getting a lot of prequels.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's worth it. Sometimes it's a story that seems like it makes sense to go back to the beginning and tell us how we got there.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense to go back to the beginning and tell us how Bruce Wayne decided to become Batman. It doesn't make sense to me, and you were talking about it a little bit earlier, it doesn't really make sense to me to go back and talk about why Michael Myers became Michael Myers. There's no reason, you know. I don't think that anyone ever watched the Halloween movies and was thinking, how did he become who he is? It was enough to say, he's crazy. He broke out of an asylum. Let's leave it at that. Like,
mythic,
like,
too.
Right.
He's a mythic character. He is the boogeyman.
I think when you look at the original Planet of the Apes movie, I do think that that's an interesting enough concept, and they just start off on a planet where apes, like, rule humans.
Mm-hmm.
That one, to me, is sort of fertile ground for a prequel. I do think that that could be an interesting one, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the project, it could be good, it could be bad. I will say I like that movie, The Escapist, that this director
made. That's
a
good movie. That's a really good movie. Yeah.
So I'm very, very sort of hopeful about that. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. I agree with you 100% about the Planet of the Apes remake, the Tim Burton movie. Not even close to the sequels, which I'm not a fan of.
But let me ask you this, though.
We're not going to have that conversation again.
Oh, no, we're not going to. Don't worry, Jamie. I'm not doing anything to make anyone uncomfortable tonight. But let me, you know, in that series of original films and playing, they do explain it. It's in a weird way, like in a very, how should I say, 70s kind of sci-fi vibe. They do explain, or the way that story progresses in those five films is explained. I think this is going to be different in one sense, because I don't think this has anything to do. I hope it has nothing to do with the remake.
I don't think they'll acknowledge.
I hope, because that would throw a big monkey, unintended monkey wrench in the.
You know, and John Lithgow couldn't do our De Palma tribute because he was off in England shooting Rise of the Apes as one of the apes, I guess. So it better be good. That's all I got to say. Here's a topic. Ed Burns. Edward Burns has returned to his indie roots, as everyone that knows anything about Edward Burns knows that when he started his career, he started it with a $25,000 feature called The Brothers McMullen that hit big. He was one of those indie auteurs of the 90s coming from that movie. He's returned to that form after, you know, successful career as an actor, and he's still an actor. I mean, his career's not over. But
his last movie was very good.
I was going to say, he's been making a lot of independent movies in that time,
too, actually. Purple
Violet. Well, no, when I say he's returned, his new movie, Nice Guy Johnny, is another independent movie that he's directed, written, and acts in, made for $25,000. With a cast of unknowns. Now, they say it's very good. My question is, are there any other directors you would recommend return to their indie roots as he did to kind of rejuvenate?
That's an interesting question. You know, whenever you say the word directors with indie roots, immediately Steven Soderbergh pops into my mind. And
mine too.
I couldn't really recommend that to him because he's really been doing that. Like, that's what he's done. His entire career, he sort of rebooted himself by making a little indie movie. He's done it over and over and over again, but, you know, from Schizopolis to
The Girlfriend Experience.
Like, he just does it over and over and over again, and I think it's sort of cathartic for him. Like, I think it's he sort of has to do that. If he's gonna, he's like, oh my God, if I'm going to make another Oceans movie, I got to sort of do something experimental for myself, just to keep myself sane. It's an interesting question. Who pops in your mind?
Kevin Smith, first and foremost, but I don't know if that's possible. I don't think he's interested in filmmaking as much as he's interested in being on the internet.
Well, they released the poster for Red State, his new horror film, the other day. So, I mean, he's making one of his long gestating projects in a different genre, so it's sure to challenge him either way. I don't know if the finished product will be any good, but who knows.
An interesting question because his whole career, people have said, hey, get away from making Dick and Fart Joke movies all the time. So he gets away from making Dick and Fart Joke movies, and they suck every time he gets away from that.
That's true. You've got a good point there. That's a very good point.
I don't know if it's a good idea. Like, I mean, I think like everyone sort of knows that he should go back to his roots because it's the only thing that he's been successful at, literally. I love it when he does that. You know,
yeah,
I'm not shitting on him. Like, I think he's fantastic at what he does.
Soderbergh is very special, though. I mean, right now he's shooting Contagion, that just has an amazing cast, and it's a kind of international story. It takes place at five or six different international locations about just that—a contagion, like a virus that wipes people out, and it's like a more epic outbreak, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very versatile. I mean, and you're right, he will return to those indie roots because it almost feels like a palate cleanser for him.
Right.
And I don't know of anyone that does that on as consistent a level as he does.
You know who needs to? You know who pops in my mind? And I love his last movie to death, and it's a huge studio movie. But how about Quentin Tarantino? How about him going back and making a little boiled down, you know, piece with, you know, some good dialogue? He doesn't need to. He's not someone who strikes me as needing to do that. I just feel like it would be a really good move for him.
He might would
back.
Love to do it.
You know, the expression you just used, palate cleanser. Like, I think that would be really, really, really strong for him. You know, to do something that doesn't... I think he's got a little bit of attention deficit disorder, and I think you can see that when you watch his movies, and I think it would be good for him to sort of like, concentrate on making something smaller.
Now, who did you just say? I was busy kicking someone out of the chat room. Who were you saying?
Tarantino. He was saying Tarantino. That's an interesting choice. Let me ask you this, Jamie. Are the criterion you're using doesn't necessarily have to be a... They could be making great movies, but you just want them to go back to their roots, sort of.
Somehow they've kind of lost their voice
Mention a reverse?
Sure. There's no hard and fast rules.
I'd like to see this director go back to making big studio movies because he did them so well, and then he went to
Coppola.
Coppola. That's what I want to see.
Is that what you were thinking of?
Yes.
Yeah, because it strikes me that he has been going back to his roots, making little independent movies, and it's not working for anyone, whether it's Tetro or, you know, the other one. no one can.
Youth Without Youth.
Youth Without Youth. I like Petro's better than Youth Without Youth, but this is a guy I'd love to see go back and make a big, big studio epic movie, you know, what he's so good at.
I don't know that he has the patience to do that anymore. I really don't. Because it's not just that he's making these little movies. It's also that he took that huge pause in between making anything whatsoever. That tells me that he just does not have the patience for those dudes. And he so famously failed in such big ways with those big studio movies, you know? I agree with you. If he's going to make a movie, I would rather see him make one Apocalypse Now than 10 Tetros. But,
right.
You know,
look, I with Coppola, I like that he's gone back to making personal, smaller films, even though I have not yet seen Tetro, ashamedly. And I could not follow Youth Without Youth. And
it's a hard movie to follow.
He admits that in our interview. He was like,
Youth Without Youth is too cerebral.
It's too philosophical. I needed to do something more emotional that people could connect to. His best work is his best work because he makes it personal. I mean, The Godfather, if shot exactly as written in the book,
would not be a classic.
Yeah, it would not be a classic.
And that's how Puzo wrote the script, too. I mean, it's like, oh, my God, we need to change this.
One of his best films is The Conversation, which is a smaller indie, very personal labor of love that he had. So I just think it's a manner of connecting to material and, you know, hitting the zeitgeist like he has many times before in his past. I don't necessarily think it has to do with budget.
No, I think Chris is right. It's a patience. It's a patience issue. I definitely think you're right.
Okay.
What about De Palma? What about De Palma? I mean, even though Redacted is like that smaller movie and everything, do we want to see him go back to like something like Hi Mom or Greetings? Is that possible even?
I think he's still working independently. I mean, you look at Redacted. He's still going Renegade.
Yeah, you know? Well, he'll always be that. That's amazing.
He's actually one of the only, and I've said this before, he's one of the only film directors who's been in it as long as he has, whose voice has not softened with age.
That's true.
He's still as protestable and incendiary as he's ever been.
You know who I'd like to see? And I like his, again, like this is a guy who, I like his modern day work, but I'd like to see him return to the subtlety of his early work, is Ridley Scott. His early work was so subtle, and I'm specifically thinking, obviously, about Alien, but even Blade Runner and, you know, the Duelists and those kind of movies. They were so subtle. They were, you know, visually very strong, but also had a sort of subtlety where it's not, you know, fucking Robin Hood. It's just, Jesus Christ, like 2 hours fucking.
Yeah, Robin Hood is the sore point there. There's another director that you bring him up, and it's not that I like this director's big films a lot, but I'd love to see the go back to the smaller films. That's Peter Weir. I wouldn't mind seeing something like The Last Wave or Picnic at Hanging Rock from him.
Yeah. His new movie's great.
Yeah, I think
they're not pushing it very much. I mean, they're not pushing it for Academy consideration, I don't think, which is a shame because as good as they say it is, they say that it has a shot. It's that good. Another person that it might happen to where they lose their way because right now they're super hot and we might years from now be talking about, man, he should return to his indie roots, is Danny Boyle.
I was going to say that. Okay, all right.
I mean, it's possible. It hasn't happened yet, but his career is at a trajectory, and I don't know Danny Boyle. I mean, I don't know if he's acceptable to that kind of temptation or change, but I could possibly see it happening.
I
don't know. I think he's so – I mean, I'm not going to make a prediction that Danny Boyle is never going to have a bad period in his career. But I do think that he's so conscientious of never sort of doing the same thing two times in a row. Like, he almost seems to go out of his way to not do it. Doesn't mean he's never going to do the same thing twice, but he never sort of does the same thing twice in a row.
Right.
I'll be honest, the trailer for 127 Hours reminds me so much. Just the tone of it reminds me so much of The Beach, which is like probably one of the most maligned movies, but a fantastic one as far as I'm concerned.
Great
soundtrack. The tone of it, it reminds me so much of The Beach. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the movie is just like it, but he's very, very conscious of never doing the same thing twice in a row.
Yeah.
Yeah, because
yeah,
they
I'm,
want him.
I'm with you.
He's always asked, because is he going to direct the sequel to Trainspotting, the book? God, I read the book a long time ago.
Porno.
Yeah, Porno. And I don't think he wants to go back to that territory. I just don't think he really wants to go back there.
Well, it's also not a great book. So.
No, it's not. It's not. There was no reason to. Irvine Welsh is a great author. Read a lot of things by him, but there was, you know. That was kind of, I guess, one of those things, like a sure thing, I guess, for, you know, some money, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, Chris, to get your take on this, because we talked about it briefly on Sunday. The Dark Knight Rises, no Riddler, no 3D.
Yeah. Good. And, you know.
Yeah.
The Riddler, just has always seemed a little bit too close to the Joker for me,
mm-hmm.
personally. Like, and comic books, listen, some of these characters like Batman or Spider-Man or Superman, like, look at a list of villains from, you know, Spider-Man or Batman or Superman. The fucking list has like 500 people on it. Like, literally, you're literally talking about, like, close to 1,000 comic books for any one of those big time characters.
Mm-hmm.
So they've really got to fill a lot of time. And some of those villains are going to be interesting, like the Joker, or, you know, Scarecrow. And some of them are going to be sort of not interesting or sort of retreads of the other characters. The Riddler is one of those, as far as I'm concerned. Not an interesting character. Like, he's just a retread of the Joker.
It would just
be what he's always been.
It just seems like it would be too. It's like they want to almost, with this third movie, follow the path of the other movies or the other series almost. And it's just like it doesn't seem like the Riddler would fit in to the story that they're telling so far. It seems too forced an idea.
Well, if what's his name, the actor from Inception and Bronson, Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy.
I mean, if he's cast as the villain, which apparently people are saying he is, who would that villain be?
Maybe it's a new villain.
Could be a lot of people. There's a lot of Batman villains. There really are. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you're just looking at the big ones, like just looking at guys that he's, you know, fought in comic books more than 10 times, you're looking at probably 25 different villains. Some of
them.
Well, seriously, like if you really break it down, like I mean, I used to read a lot of Batman comic books,
right.
and really, you're talking about probably about 25 villains that he's just sort of gone that you would consider to be. Recurrent villains in Batman comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those are more conceivable in this Chris Nolan Batman mm-hmm. world, and some of them are much, much less conceivable.
Right.
Someone like Clayface is very inconceivable to me in this Batman world. You know?
Yeah, I don't really see that happening.
Yeah, he's basically like the Sandman from... and that's the other thing. A lot of characters from the DC universe are complete rip-offs from the Marvel universe, and vice versa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Clayface is basically a rip-off of Sandman, or the Absorbing Man. You're really looking at Catwoman, Penguin, Bane... Harley Quinn, these are the kind of villains that you're really looking at. But listen, the first movie took two very obscure Batman, or not very, but relatively obscure, in the Batman canon, Scarecrow and Ra's al Ghul are not the two first ones that you think of. So
right.
I would not be surprised at all if Chris Nolan took a much more sort of obscure villain, or even a villain that is not from the canon of Batman. You know,
Ra's daughter himself,
Ra's
yeah.
daughter could be. You know, a lot of people have been talking that up.
Yeah,
Talia
al Ghul.
That's
possible, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if he made up something completely. Or I also would not be surprised to find something like the Penguin. I don't think the Catwoman is believable, but I do think that the Penguin would sort of fit into that mob world that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I can sort of see how they would sort of meld that character into the real world. You really have to look at the characters that are real world characters.
Yeah.
And let's not forget also that, and I know he said he's not going to use the Joker, But the Joker did not die in The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
So it is possible that the Joker is in Arkham Asylum, and you do have possibility for someone like Harley Quinn.
Right.
I love the title, Dark Knight Rises, because the second movie ends with the Dark Knight sort of as a villain,
mm-hmm.
and I like the idea that something has brought him out of the darkness. Hopefully
right.
there's been a good amount of time since the second movie. You know, I like the idea that it's not the Riddler. I like very much the idea that it's not in 3D. I saw
thank
Jackass,
God, yeah.
I saw Jackass 3D in 3D, and it was, you know, it was unnecessary. It's unnecessary unless the filmmaker has a commitment to it. And Chris Nolan has said time and again that he does not have a commitment to 3D. So I'm all for 3D if the filmmaker is into it. If he's not, don't make it in 3D.
Right.
Because he's not going to use it as it's supposed to be used.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we talked about Coppola a little earlier. I mentioned it on Sunday's show, but just to mention it again, he is shooting his next movie. He's been shooting it for a little while, apparently, a horror movie, his first since Dementia 13, with Val Kilmer. It's being shot on his vineyard.
God, that'd be great. You get to be on the cast and crew of that. You get free wine. That's awesome. All right.
That's what's financing these movies.
You know? No, that is. That and the hotel. That and the hotel business.
He's a wealthy man, not for movies.
You know, it's not. Hey, he'll be the first to say that. What was it? There was something else. Going back to the comic book villains. I noticed that in this new Spider-Man, they are also taking that Batman Begins, villain track, sort of lesser known. I think it's the Vulture. I think is the villain.
Right.
Yeah, so they're taking. I noticed they're using.
Wasn't
that
the Vulture
same
in the third Spider-Man?
Oh, that
was the Vulture? I thought it was the Lizard.
Oh, it's the Lizard. I read somewhere it was the Vulture, but I could be wrong. I mean, but it's still, they're going on, I think they're going for that same strategy.
Mm.
Yeah. I was watching the Spider-Man movies the other day. It's playing them on HBO recently. And Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies are pretty fucking good.
Yeah, they are.
I think so, too. Yeah.
They're really, really watchable, and even the third one, which I sort of need to apologize for, and I won't apologize completely because it's not as good as the first two, but his movies are really, really watchable. They're sort of the movies that you can watch when they come on cable, and you
right.
turn it to it, and they're so sort of beautifully shot and just sort of quirky and kind of funny and sort of harmless, but also sort of interesting to look at as far as the action goes.
Mm-hmm.
They look more like the comic book than probably any other
yeah.
comic book movie.
Well, that's true. That's very true.
And they're a lot of fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about this idea of rebooting something that was that good so close to it. I understand rebooting the Hulk because a lot of people didn't think it was that good, but I think it's sort of you're getting into scary territory when you reboot something that was really good and
yeah.
really well received that close to it.
My only beef, I think when we talked about Spider-Man 3, God, that was like when we first started, I think the main problem for me with that film is it was just too much going on. If they had just like sort of trimmed some of it, I think he would have had a really decent third film on his hands.
Yeah,
it was
that's,
Venom.
That's
they
the
had
danger.
The shoehorn
yeah.
Venom in there.
Yeah. If they had kept that out, I would have said the movie was actually, you know, pretty decent. You know, pretty decent follow-up.
Okay, Venom. Venom was the villain of the third one, not Vulture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, it was no. Venom and Sandman. But
right.
Sam Raimi wanted Sandman, and the whoever it was, Warner Brothers or who made that movie? Sony.
Sony. Yeah.
They wanted Venom because the fans wanted Venom, and Sam Raimi is more of a 60s fan of the 60s comic books, where the Sinister Six were the villains,
right.
and Venom. Is a villain from the 80s and 90s. So they shoehorned it in, and it felt like it was shoehorned.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
It felt half-hearted, and it also felt too villain-heavy, you know, which
mm-hmm.
is a mistake these movies always make. They always
mm-hmm.
throw too many villains in, and it doesn't work.
I think so, too. But I was watching Spider-Man 2 again last week, too, and it is an amazing sequel.
Yeah.
And such a nice quirky sense of humor in that movie. And I remember watching it with you and Mark at the theater, Chris. The three of us went together, and we all started laughing at the same moment. and it just goes completely over everyone's head. The raindrops keep falling on my head.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The freeze frame at the end of the sequence that that looks so retro, and it just it's cracks me up.
Yeah.
And they're very emotional too. I mean,
yeah, it is. That's what I like about the second one. It is very emotional. I think that's why it holds
perfectly
up.
Perfectly cast with Tobey Maguire, I thought.
Yeah.
You know, so it's good stuff. Catwoman is she might not be strong enough to be a character in the next Batman, but they're pushing Halle Berry. You know how they the Jeff Bridges for Crazy Heart was a last minute addition last year. And it paid off. It was a movie that was in their vault, and they looked at it and they said, this is best actor material. Let's put it out. They decided, like, in October or November, let's put it out real quick.
Right, it was going to be like a CMT original movie or something like that.
Yeah, and they just lightning struck with that.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying the same with Halle Berry this year in a movie called Frankie and Alice. They're pushing it. Its regular theatrical release is February 4th, but it's going to have a qualifying run on December 17th in New York and L.A. So I guess this is another kind of raw, dramatic Halle Berry performance. Is she a good actress?
Listen,
you have to bring this up, don't you, Jamie? You just have to do this.
When you're, when you play the fucking part of, like, you know, a black woman who's downtrodden and poor and sort of lost a son or is losing, I don't remember how the story happened, but like, and by the way, you're getting banged by Billy Bob Thornton on a couch and
your son gets hit by a car.
Right. And you're screaming and moaning and talking in a really appropriate way during this sex scene. And like, you spend half the movie either crying or getting banged by Billy Bob Thornton on a couch. Like, you're going to win an Academy Award. Like, you could have.
Wait, Lauren Graham didn't win one in Bad Santa. Wasn't even nominated. She got
right.
Banged.
Well, there wasn't enough crying and dead child. Like,
okay.
It, like, literally that part, I remember nothing from her performance from that movie,
mm-hmm.
other than her getting banged by Billy Bob Thornton on a couch and crying a lot. Like, there's no scene. There's no, you know, like, I like it when the Academy Awards, like, when they recognize a scene from an actor that is memorable, you know, like, not necessarily a scene, but a performance that has a scene like that, or has anything that's memorable. To me, that Monsters Ball performance has nothing that was memorable in it. There's mm-hmm. nothing that was truly, truly, like, told me, like, she is just at the top of her game right now. Seemed like a lot of crying and getting banged by Billy Bob Thornton on a couch. Like,
I have to say I agree with Chris. I mean, she, don't get me wrong, she's a beautiful girl and everything, and, you know, there's some decent films in there, but Monsters Ball, I mean, I just remember Heath Ledger, really. I don't remember much about the movie, to be honest with you.
Even if you say that Monsters Ball was a great movie and a great performance, name me one other. I don't want to go way overboard and say that she's not a good actress. I just feel like she falls into that category of someone like Kate Hudson or someone like Sandra Bullock, who we've been talking about them for a long movie, and they've been making a lot of really bad movies in the meantime. And I can forgive a lot of bad movies. Please make a couple good movies in the meantime. Like, just a seasoning of good movies in there. Like, and there really aren't any when you talk about those names that I just mentioned. They don't exist.
I guess that one with Benicio Del Toro, Things We Lost in the Fire, the one with David Duchovny, that was all right. But that's the last thing I remember watching her in. So
she was good in that. She was good in Dorothy Dandridge. I mean,
that's the movie. That's really, I think, probably her best role, introducing
Dorothy
Dandridge.
She's a good, capable actress, but like all people, I mean, it depends on the caliber of role, you know, that they get. Frankie and Alice is a psychological drama based on the harrowing true story of Frankie Murdoch, played
mm-hmm.
by Halle Berry, who is a woman suffering with multiple personality disorder in early 1970s Los Angeles. Just that tagline spells Oscar to me, potential Best Actress Oscar.
Yeah,
I mean, who knows?
But we can't be too soon. That sort of stuff gets tricky these days, because it used to be that way, that you could sort of hear something like that and be like, Oscar material. But we've seen all the King's Men, And we've seen The Soloist, and these things don't always
they fizzle. They fizzle.
Yeah.
I mean,
sometimes it's a little bit too obvious that you are picturing that, you know, Oscar ceremony when you're doing this scene.
But is it important to actually? But is it important? Is it important to actually make a great film? I mean,
to get a Best Actor or a Best Actress, you mean?
Yeah, how much does that play a role?
No, it doesn't always. No. Sometimes it's a performance, you know. It's just that the performance. It doesn't have to be a great film.
Absolutely.
I think for this year, from what we talked about a couple months ago, it seems like Natalie Portman and Black Swan.
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
Oh.
But now the other thing, though, I'm thinking, though, is Naomi Watts for Fair Game and Sean Penn. I mean, that seems to be something that could be...
it's getting great reviews.
Yeah, so I wouldn't rule
Armand White panned it today, so...
Well, there you go. I mean...
yeah, that's getting very good reviews. I saw Richard Roper. He had three A-grade movies in a row. He said it's the first time he's ever had that with Fair Game, 127 Hours, and Hereafter. Those were his last three reviews, and he gave them all A's.
Wow, okay.
So yeah, Fair Game I'm looking forward to, and apparently Doug Liman has gone the way of Fincher in a way, kind of like a novelistic, no frills, very competent, strong storytelling standpoint. I mean, he can't rely on pyrotechnics that he does in movies like Go or the Bourne films, which that style is ideally suited for those films, but this is a different thing altogether.
Well, it's got to be better than Jumper.
Fair Game, better than Jumper. Will that be
it's got to be. Just a story. I mean, what I'd like to see this is going to be a straight... I mean, I love the Rod Laurie variation on this, Nothing But the Truth, but that's a very fictionalized what happened. This is going to be a straightforward docudrama, but I got to say, it just looks a trailer. Everything looks perfect. Of that time period, so.
I agree. Chris, anything else on your mind?
Oh, Jesus Christ. No.
Oh, he's on your mind, too? Okay, all right.
No, he's almost never on my mind.
Was he on your mind when you voted yesterday?
Was he on my mind when I voted? Absolutely not, no. Although, except for the fact that I was voting in a church like 99% of the United States, which is ironic. No. What is up with that, by the way? Why do we have to vote in churches?
You voted.
I guess there are lots of churches that are in close vicinity of people in various neighborhoods, so it's just a matter of convenience, I think. I mean, it's better than a gas station. I mean...
I don't know about that.
We vote in schools here. We vote in the schools. So.
I voted in the gym. I went to the gym to vote. It's the only time I make it to the gym.
that's a gay bar here in town?
It's an actual gym. It's Kelly Rec. Sorry.
I'm just kidding. Hey, odds-on favorite. You know what's weird? Best Picture this year. What's going to win that? Like, there's nothing that, again, like, it's one of these years that there's nothing that jumps out, you know? Nothing,
True Grit.
Literally nothing.
True Grit.
True Grit seems, or The Social Network, maybe.
Yeah.
Social Network, I find difficult to believe. True Grit is sort of unproven, you know?
It's unproven. Nobody's seen it, but yeah.
Right. We're in November. Well, listen, Burn After Reading, Lady Killers.
That's true. No,
that's like,
true. What about the Boyle film, 127 Hours?
No way. No chance.
You don't think lightning will strike twice for Mr. Boyle? Okay.
Does that seem like Best Picture material to you?
No, I don't know.
There is such a thing as Best Picture material. There is. Like, there just is.
Social Network, then? I would think that would fit the criteria.
You seriously think that The Social Network fits the criteria? I love that movie. It's my favorite movie of the year.
Yeah.
I find it difficult to believe that that will fit the... fits the criteria that we all know of that exists for a Best Picture movie that rarely, very rarely, is overcome.
I don't think it will, but I think there are examples of other movies from the past that stack up to Social Network. But
okay,
we're dealing with 10 nominees.
Yeah, that's
not all of them. Not all of them that get in are going to be Best Picture material.
No,
I mean, unfortunately.
No, that's true, but the one that wins will be most likely Best Picture material. You know, it'll be, ironically, you know, is it going to be something like The King's Speech? Is it going to be something like that, that we're going to be winning the Best Picture? Because there's nothing that we've really seen this year so far that just screams Best Picture to me.
Right now, I'm thinking True Grit.
But what about the Coppola movie Somewhere, or is that... You don't think that will get the?
I think that's gonna be so under the radar. That's what I want you to do. I think it's a good original screenplay before anything. It might very well get an original screenplay, based on Sophia. I have to say no.
Really? Okay. No, the reason I say that is because they have been talking that up. At least her performance.
And I absolutely bought into it, hook, line, and sinker, and she is fantastic in the movie. She's gorgeous in the movie. I want her. I'm not ashamed to say it. It's not like an Academy level character as written, you know?
Okay.
I hate to say it, but if she became completely debilitated from her disease in the movie,
mm-hmm.
then she'd be in.
That's
the God's honest truth.
All right. Let me throw out this one then, and this you guys might laugh at me, you might not. Inception.
Yes.
No.
Inception will be nominated for Best Picture. Toy Story 3
will
be nominated for Best Picture.
But will not.
No.
Toy Story 3 is an interesting one. Toy Story 3, more than any other title that we have named, I think probably has the better chance. Literally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, eventually some animated movie has got to win Best Picture. Eventually it is going to happen, I think. And I think that the animated movies are coming closer to that thing that we're talking about, that Best Picture quality. The animated movies have that quality more than any other sort of genre of movies, more than the Inceptions and more than the Social Networks. Toy Story 3 fits that.
Okay, let me name another one. And I actually think this would be, I think, just given the nature of the events this year, I think The Kids Are All Right has a shot.
That'll be up for Best Picture. It'll definitely be up for screenplay. One of those two ladies will be up for actress. So, I mean, that movie will be well represented. If it's a great movie, I still think True Grit has the best chance of winning Best Picture.
Okay, winning, yeah. I just think Kids Are All Right, though, has a shot at getting some nominations. What else? Greenberg wasn't well received.
No.
I think Greenberg for the longest time was one of my favorite movies this year. But it's just
me
not.
Me too. I just don't think it falls into that category.
I think you're absolutely right. For a while there, because there's nothing else out of that magnitude. But no, Chris, you're right. It's just I'm just throwing that out there. The other film, I think some of the independent films that I liked a lot in the first half of the year, I see them better shots at the Spirit Awards than I do the Oscars.
This is why I asked the question, because to me this year, more than any other year in recent memory, there's just no front runner. There's just nothing that stands out. And even True Grit, as much as I can understand why you would choose that, Jamie, as much as I can understand that, knowing the story and knowing, you know, like I do, I find it difficult to believe the finished product will be something that will become a Best Picture winner. You know what I mean? It's very tough for me to believe. On paper.
And No Country for Old Men, when you walked out of that, did you think it would win Best Picture?
Did I think it would win? No, but it felt like the kind of movie. No Country for Old Men and True Grit do not fall into the same category. I have not seen the movie, but I have read the book, and I've seen the original movie, and I know that the tone of the two movies I don't think will be on par. And also, No Country for Old Men was sort of a redefining of genre. It was sort of, you know, oh, this is the Western, except this is the Western in 1982 or whenever that movie was supposed to have
taken place.
And True Grit is just a Western. I mean, it's a straightforward Western.
I do think Natalie Portman has a great shot at being front runner for Best Actress, though.
There's another film to consider. The Fighter. Is The Fighter, I mean, is a possibility. A possibility,
yeah.
Not a winner, just a possibility of getting some nominations in there.
I think it definitely has a possibility of getting nominated. I just saw that trailer. I really was taken by it. I was taken by Christian Bale in the trailer and disappointed I didn't see more of him in the trailer, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that might be a calculated move. And I wouldn't be surprised if he was one of those names that we were talking about come awards season. In the supporting actor category, because just knowing you know the history of Dickie Edlund, you know, crack addict, and you know, like the only guy that could lead his brother to victory, and you know, all those fights against Arturo Gatti, and you know, it's a really, really, and they don't even get into the Arturo Gatti stuff in the movie, from what I understand. But yeah, that trailer is really, really strong. Just David O. Russell, knowing how he throws himself into a project, it's going to be interesting to see how he sort of throws himself into a director-for-hire project, because, you know, he sort of has done Spanking the Monkey and Flirting with Disaster and Three Kings and I Heart Huckabees and then this Nailed project that sort of, you know, sort of stalled. I don't think he's really done something that was a director-for-hire project, and the trailer's very strong.
Yeah,
I can see that come award season being one of those names that we're talking about.
So we don't see any recognition for Stallone in Expendables?
No, I don't. Not that I mean, it would be fine, but I don't see it. I don't.
You
would
have
a
problem
with
that, Jerry?
It's a fun movie. Don't get me wrong, but I just don't see it. Let me ask you this though, because we're talking about film. All right, let's just talk about, as far as big event movies go.
Yeah,
I think Inception is definitely in it. What about Tron Legacy?
Oh, man. I just saw the preview for that again today when I went and saw Jackass. And, wow, that preview looks really, really... First of all, the first Tron movie sucks, let's be honest.
You're not going to hear nostalgia from me on that, okay?
No, it's really bad. Time has not been kind to that movie. It just hasn't. I watched it when I was a kid, so I love it still, but time has not been kind at all. And the trailer for Tron 2.0 looks really, really good. I mean, really good. Like, it looks exciting. The music is interesting.
Yeah.
The visuals look fantastic. It's got Jeff Bridges. That's fantastic. But when they show that CGI Jeff Bridges, it's like I can hear the fucking record scratch. Like, whoop! Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's just so jarring how that looks. And, you know, the CGI characters, like, they either get it really, really right, and when they get it really right, it's usually with something like Gollum, or, you know, it's usually with something that's not completely human, or the Avatar, or the Na'vi in Avatar is another good example. It's something that's humanoid, but not exactly human. That's when the CGI works. But when you try and, we've still not seen a CGI human, 100% human, that I buy completely. And I don't know if we ever will. It just does. So something about the lips and the way they move when they talk, it doesn't work for me. Am I the only one that feels that way when I see that preview? Like, it's jarring to me.
No, I feel that way, too.
There's something really weird about it. I don't know. I mean, I was not one of these people clamoring for a sequel for this. So
I know. It's like when they give the phone number in a movie and they're like, 555, like, it immediately, like, picks you out. Oh, I'm watching a movie. Like, immediately, like, record scratches and you're pulled out of the narrative of the movie.
Right.
Because, you know, and that's how I feel with the CGI Jeff Bridges. Like, I hope that's not going to be a deal breaker as far as that movie goes. But it looks really, really strong other than that. Like, I'm totally there.
I think it looks strong, too. It's definitely going to be a visual effects bonanza at the Oscars.
Two movies, though, from the beginning of the year. One was actually a holdover from the previous year. Do you think Shutter Island or The Ghost Rider have any chance?
Ghost Rider, yes. Shutter Island, no. Ghost Rider is, for my money, one of, you know, top five movies of the year.
Yeah, me too. I agree.
Shutter Island does not fall into that category. And I like Shutter Island, but there's just been, too many other... If we're talking top 20 movies of the year, yes, Shutter Island. Top 10, no. No, it doesn't fall
okay.
in that category.
Okay.
But Ghost Rider is one of the best of the year, bar none. Like,
right.
just solid.
But you see how we forget about it, though, because it's so early in the year.
That movie will be represented as far as screenwriting goes. I wouldn't be surprised to see it in, you know, maybe even a Best Director category.
Oh, I'd love to see a Best Director, just to piss people off.
I could see that happening. I could even see a Best Supporting Actress for Olivia Williams kind of thing happening. I don't know about Ewan McGregor or Pierce Brosnan. I don't think that either of those, to me, were not strong enough for Best Actor or Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, and I would personally, because our show's about to end, but I just want to say I would personally love to see Shutter Island represented for cinematography. Because
mm-hmm.
that is
oh, yeah.
one beautifully shot movie.
Right.
It's sumptuous.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, God. Okay. Lots of exciting things happening. Sunday night we have J.W. Rensler, who works for Lucasfilm, who wrote The Making of The Empire Strikes Back. He'll be talking about that book and his research for it. We also have some really exciting guests coming up in the future this month, including Kerry Washington, Anthony Mackie, and a couple of biggies that I can't announce right yet because we don't have final confirmation. But let me tell you, this Kubrick show is looking like... it's gonna be the bomb.
It's okay, awesome.
Yeah, and I don't use that term, the bomb.
No, you don't. Lately. No, hardly ever.
All right. So, Chris, the three of us are going to get together just for a private show to record as long as we want to about Kubrick. Okay, pretty
awesome.
Soon in the next couple of weeks.
Awesome. Cool. Okay.
Sounds fun.
And then we're going to use that footage for parts of the show. So, all right, guys, we're going to close the show with a score from a new movie called The Bird Can't Fly. The music is composed by Paul Hepker and Mark Killian, another Mark Killian score we got here.
Cool.
If you guys want to hear the premiere of the Harry Potter score from Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, not in 3D, tune in to our archive for Sunday night show. It plays at the end of that show. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good night, everyone.
See you guys next time.